Welcome to Things I Wish I Knew, the podcast from Thinking Faith, a work of the Jesuits in Britain. I'm Julia, I'm in my early 30s, and I used to live in a Jesuit young adult community. We all live hectic lives and often don't get time to reflect on what's happening both to us and around us. This podcast is meant to help you to take a moment to stop and to think about where you are, where you're going, and where your relationship with God fits into it all. Every week I'll meet a new guest who tells me about something they experienced which has changed their lives forever. By talking about the things they wish they'd known at the time, we'll explore the idea that God is in all things, and we'll talk about the part that faith plays in navigating life challenges. Today I'm speaking to Maria, who works for St. Bino's, the Jesuit Retreat Centre. She speaks about her experience of studying Islam and stepping into interreligious space. I learned a lot from this conversation and about challenging misconceptions. So Maria, how did you end up studying Islam?
So I did my first degree in history at Queen Mary, University of London. And I actually went into history thinking that I was going to study 20th century political history, so fascism, specifically the Spanish Civil War and the relations with Nazism and things like that. I mean, I have a lot of messed up history on my Spanish side, so that always interested me. And then I basically took a random class by this amazing professor on Muhammad to the Ottomans, which is like the whole of Islamic history. He just opened the first lecture speaking about the richness of the Middle East and all of the different types of people that lived there. And I was just hooked. And I literally switched all my classes to that professor's classes, which was super interesting because I actually hated medieval history before that. I always got really bad grades on like English medieval history. I just couldn't quite crack it. But for some reason, I just loved studying Middle Eastern history. And I think also that Spanish connection as well, because I come from Córdoba, which was Muslim for 700 years.
So what were your views on Islam before you studied it?
Interesting. I guess we've got to take it back to my teen years. I went to a state school, Catholic school, suburbs of London. It was very white, a lot of casual racism, and just views about people different to me were not great, especially about Muslims. I had this sort of general view that a lot of the British public hold of like violence and extremism and why do women wear headscarves? And I remember there was a woman on my road who had the niqab and I used to be scared of her, which is ridiculous now that I think about it. But as a kid, like I didn't know any better. There's also a Spanish context there. So like growing up hearing my mum and my uncle and my relatives talking about like the reconquest of Spain, and that's quite a big deal, and the Christianization of Spain and like the Muslims and how they ruled us and it was terrible and all these sorts of things. And then also I grew up in a Catholic group in London, which also has that Spanish-Italian context, and the rhetoric there about Muslims was not great. A lot of jokes, a lot of things said like the Islamic God is different to our God. I sort of grew up with all those things. And also a child of social media and the internet, the algorithm is, you know, it wants to show you more extreme content, right? So I would just end up in polemics that weren't actually very academic or anything. They were just random people on the internet spewing rubbish.
So what did challenge your early views of Islam and Islamic communities?
I would say the first thing is that I then went to a different sixth form called St. Dominic's, Great Sixth Form.
In Harrow?
Yeah.
I went there.
That's crazy. We both went to St. Dom's.
Yeah. I was actually preparing for this interview and thinking of what you're about to say. So maybe I'll let you say that and then I'll finish my story.
Cool. Big up St. Dom's.
I was basically thinking about how I sat next to someone who was Muslim and how that challenged my misconceptions about people who were Muslim. And so I was like, oh, that's so interesting, not realising that you'd also gone to the same sixth form.
And also had exactly the same experience in my English class. So this sixth form, although it's Catholic, is quite diverse. And there's a lot of different religious people there, of different faiths, different cultures, different countries. And basically, like you, I sat next to a Muslim girl in my English class. And I remember we were studying Khalid Husseini's book, The Kite Runner. And the English teacher had some weird views, not going to lie to you. She would ask the Muslim students in the class like completely inappropriate questions. And then I would also ask this poor girl next to me, these questions about her faith, and quite like intrusive ones as well. And she would answer them with such grace. And like, she was so humble and so friendly. And I met so many Muslims at sixth form like that. So that already started to shift my gears. And then I went to uni. And when I switched all my classes to Islamic classes, I was suddenly surrounded by majority Muslim friends. Like, it was, I think, one of my classes, I was the only non-Muslim. Everyone else was Muslim. And they were so nice to me. I learned so much from them. And like, I would do stupid things. Like, I remember I had a ham sandwich and I like left the room to eat it. And they're like, what are you doing? You can eat your ham sandwich here. Like, we're not going to like burst into flames from the smell of a ham sandwich. Like, so many things. And yeah.
Oh, I could tell you so many stories. But I was in my maths class having similar experiences. And I used to, not thinking about it, used to sing to myself while I was doing my maths. And then I was in the chapel with this girl and the chaplain was like, is it okay if we play music? Because for some Muslims, they're not allowed to listen to Christian music, or Western music, I should say, as well. And I felt so terrible because I didn't know this. And I had just been singing at her like most of our maths classes. But she was very great, as you said, very graceful and very like, no, it's okay. You didn't know. It's fine. You're just singing. It's allowed. That and many conversations really, really challenged me. So then you went on to university to do Islamic studies. What stood out to you when you were doing that?
I think the thing that stood out to me was how varied Islamic history actually is. I had this idea in my head of like, you know, the five pillars of Islam, this is what they believe and this is what they do. But actually, just like Christianity, there's so many different denominations. I mean, from about the mid to late 700s onwards, you've got opposing Muslim empires that are fighting each other. And Islam spreads over all of these different cultures and across the continent. And it was just so rich and varied. And also what really interested me was that for the first 400 years of Islamic rule, the majority of the population living there actually remained Christian. Because, you know, you don't read or write. It's a lot harder to travel. You're kind of in your village. And conversion was slow. So actually, it develops this really rich transference of culture and ideas, and people are adopting different things from different places, but it's all really slow. So I became really interested in the family life and sexuality in the medieval period in the Middle East. So, for example, when a father converts to Islam for whatever reasons, maybe personal or economic or social reasons, what does the family life look like? Is the mum still Christian? Does she pray with her children? In what language? What is she saying when she prays? Do the kids' names change as well? Because sometimes you find that they would change their names to be more Islamic, but they still practice Christianity at home. And also, yeah, what that looks like from a sexuality perspective, because there's different sexual laws to do with purity and things like that. And I just found that so interesting. I mean, also, there's a lot of shared spaces. Like, actually, before mosques were built, there's evidence that Muslims worshipped in churches or even church courtyards and shared spaces and shared festivals as well. And that lasts so long, like even up until the 18th, 19th century, Palestinian Muslims were still baptizing their children. A slightly different wording, but because everyone's illiterate, they didn't theologically necessarily understand it. But, you know, a priest turns up and they're like, actually, I can't baptize your kid anymore because your family's converted. And they're like, what do you mean? I don't want my kids to have evil spirits. So actually the priest developed a slightly different right to still pastorally care for those people.
Wow. So did your academic study of Islam challenge or affirm your own Catholic faith?
I feel like to answer that, we've got to backtrack to my own experience of my faith.
Okay.
So at Queen Mary, so my first degree, I'd left the church. Mm-hmm. I was sort of studying religious history, probably to try and understand it a lot more and be like, what did I grow up with? What do I agree with? What do I not agree with? What do I know better? You know? And then I had an experience of really bad anxiety and really challenging mental health problems. And basically, through various different reasons, I discovered God. And then a year forward, I discovered the Eucharist. So by the time I ended up at Oxford to study Islamic history, my faith had changed, shifted. So when I look back at my essays in Queen Mary, they're very like academic, quite legalistic, I mean, in a fun way, but very academic. But then in Oxford, they're very much like asking existential questions, and you can see in it that like my gears have shifted. I mean, like I started one of my essays on humans in the Quran with like, who are we? How did we get here? Is God involved in any of this? Which like you can't start an Oxford essay like that, which is probably why I got marked down. But so in terms of then answering that question, I think for me, it did affirm my faith actually as a Christian, because although from my experience and also reading church documents, I was really into reading Vatican II, funnily enough, I discovered that actually the church teaches that Muslims are to be held in high esteem, like it says in Nostra Aetate. Muslims are to be held in high esteem, and that they adore the one God, and that we should work together for mutual understanding, social justice, and freedom. So that really affirmed, like, okay, I'm studying this for a reason. We can work together. I then got involved in the Centre for Muslim and Christian Studies at Oxford, which was really fun. And what it affirmed intellectually for me was that we have a lot of the same principles. I do believe that Jesus Christ is God and is the Son of God and became incarnate to save me. And I didn't have to get closer to God through the law or through like finding myself or anything like that, but that he loved me like in the pit of death. Like at my lowest point, Christ died for me and rose again. And that's really important to me, whereas there isn't that in Islam. And also this concept of loving your enemies. There is a section in the Quran which does say that God can bring together enemies and make them love each other. But there isn't a command to love your enemies and pray for your enemies. And that, again, because of my history, has really touched me. And that's why I'm a Christian.
I want to go back to your talking about the Quran, because I don't think a lot of people in this country will have even looked at a Quran, let alone have read it. And you read the Quran and the Bible. So how did that change your view of scripture?
When I was working with the Centre for Muslim and Christian Studies, what I did basically was I worked with a fellow Muslim colleague, and we would do shared scriptural readings where we would choose a theme like love or money or war or the weather or climate change or whatever it was. And we would choose three passages from our own scripture and bring it and analyze it with a group of people. And it wasn't supposed to try and convert the other person, the other group. It wasn't supposed to like evangelize. It was just to kind of be with each other and see that actually we've got very similar themes. So that was really fruitful thing that I did for me anyway. And then in terms of kind of academic studying of both things, I guess because I believe that the Word was made flesh and that the Bible is, you know, it's the Word of God and it's alive and it speaks to me, it has something to say to me. Whereas I don't believe that about the Quran. I was, even with the interfaith training I'd had, and also I was also part of something called the Love and Religion Project at my college, I was able to still approach the Quran with, you know, respect, and they believe very similar things. What I will say is that the Bible is much bigger. The Quran is actually quite small in comparison, but it doesn't mean it's easier to read because the Bible is like, it's a collection of different genres. You've got poems in there, you've got letters, you've got chronological data, narratives, you've got legends, visions, Whereas the Quran is quite different in the sense that it's supposed to be sung. So almost like the Psalms, that's what the Quran is like. So actually, from an academic perspective, I found it very difficult to read because my Arabic's not very good and it's much more beautiful in Arabic because of that singing element. But because of that singing element, it jumps topic. So if you want to discover a theme, or for example, if you want to look at a figure or a prophet or something in the Quran, you've got to jump around loads of different sections. Whereas in the Bible, it's much more, this chapter is this and this book is this. All the themes do relate. It's a little bit different.
I just want to ask, what is the Love and Religion Project that you mentioned?
So the Love and Religion Project is a project at Regent's Park College, which is my college at Oxford. And basically, they just wanted to explore the theme of love in religion. And it was mainly Abrahamic. So they had Jewish scholars, Muslim scholars and Christian scholars. And they bring together their research on this theme of love, again, as like a common point and where we go from there and why that's important. I mean, it's funded by, part of the funding comes from Jordanian royalty. So there is like a really important connection there for the wider global scene.
That sounds very interesting. Talking of Jordan, I believe you spent some time there. What was that like?
Yeah, so my master's was 2 years. And in that summer, they really encouraged us to go to an Arabic speaking country for obvious reasons. Arabic is so hard. I actually failed my first Arabic exam. So I failed my first year, which was really humiliating. So I desperately needed to go to Jordan. And it was fantastic. Some of my best memories. I had an amazing Arabic teacher who was actually an engineer for Royal Jordanian Airlines and BA, but his wife had a language school and she was more into the speaking side of it. But she found that more and more students were coming from the West to do like hardcore theological Arabic. And she was like, okay, we need to bring in Waleed, my husband. He would read like hadith just to read it. He was really into it. So basically he taught me and he was hardcore. He was like strict and like a lot of content, but he explained it in a way that I just didn't understand from my teachers at Oxford. And it really helped me. And then also his family was so welcoming to me. Like, I know the cliche, the Middle East is very hospitable. Everyone, you know, is ingrained in their culture, but it really is. Like, they would just invite me to their house all the time and bring me food and were super friendly. And I met the whole like extended family. And then also the same thing with my landlady, Rima, who was a very eccentric woman. But again, like, she would invite all of us girls that lived in the flat to her house every Friday. Super welcoming, like a whole feast just for breakfast. And I learned so much from them about hospitality, about friendship, and also about how people who are Muslim that live in a Muslim majority country actually live their faith and the different levels of devoutness as well. Another thing that I want to mention is actually that I think my previous views about women in Islam were quite negative, especially when I was a teenager and sort of started to learn about these things. But in Jordan, obviously it's interpretation dependent. And there's different countries that have different laws. But in Jordan, there's a real emphasis on respecting the woman and respecting the family. And there's really strong family values. And even though I had to dress very modestly and in different parts of Amman, like I would roll down my sleeves depending if I was walking into a more conservative area or not, I did feel quite respected as a woman. And I also found those single sex spaces quite healing. Even silly things like, I was always scared to go to the gym because I felt very objectified in the UK and I felt silly and all these strong men in the weight section and I can't, and they're just staring at me. But they had different hours for men and women, which was fantastic. Like, I got so strong. I would chat to these like normal women, normal Muslim women in this gym, and it was fantastic. And there was no men. It was great.
I do understand that whole thing of feeling intimidated by men in the gym. Like, and what was it like when you returned back to the UK?
My Arabic was much improved. I actually felt like I was getting somewhere. I could finish my degree, not fail it. I think Jordan, especially Amman, is actually quite modern. And they've got, you know, all the stuff we have here, like big supermarkets and shopping centres and all that sort of stuff. So it wasn't so much like a culture shock of returning home. I left actually with a lot of friends and a lot of funny stories, like the eggs in Jordan are labelled vegan because there's just a mistranslation there, vegetarian and vegan, which is just quite funny. also like being at my teacher's house and he's got like a cigarette in hand and he's pouring all the coffee and he's like, I'm actually quit smoking. I'm like, you're holding a cigarette. Like, it's just, or like the doctors, they're all smoke. So funny stories mainly, but one of the things that I did encounter in Jordan is basically it's one of the first places that refugees go from the surrounding countries. I actually volunteered a bit with the Jesuit Refugee Service. That was my first encounter with the Jesuits, actually. And I heard their stories and I met their suffering. And also I lived on a road that was mainly Iraqi Christians that had escaped from ISIS. And also the church group that I was a part of, half of them were Jordanian, but half of them were Palestinian. So hearing their stories, they're stood in front of you, like talking about their experiences. It's not just something that you're reading. I came back with, you know, a real sense that I'd heard these people's suffering and that had somehow changed how I viewed the world and or affirmed actually how I viewed the world even more so. And when I'm talking to people here about world conflicts and refugees, I can talk about these people's stories that otherwise, like, it's not often you get to encounter someone in front of you who's telling you how they suffered, how their family suffered.
I always find that when you have people's stories and you're having a discussion with someone who might have some misconceptions, when you can actually share someone's story of that you've met, that always challenges both you and them and develops that conversation much deeper than it would have if you were just talking about general facts.
100%. And it also actually affirmed my academic endeavours to look at real people. I mean, the elites that were writing in the medieval period are also real people, but like the family life and what everyday people are doing and the peasants and like the people walking around in the market, I think their stories and their history is so important to like figuring out our purpose and our purpose regarding others and how we relate to people. And I think meeting families in Jordan and them being so welcoming and hearing their stories of suffering just really affirmed sort of what I was doing intellectually.
So when you got back from Jordan, what were you doing intellectually?
I was doing my last year of my master's. So actually the main thing that I did that year was my main project, which was on a 10th century sexuality manual from Baghdad.
I want to know how you ended up with that as a topic.
So for my undergrad dissertation, I came across this manual called the Jawami al-Ladha. And I was like, okay, that's cool. And then when I went to Oxford, they were like, don't choose a topic, don't choose a theme. You need to find a source or an author and do that. So I was like, okay, well, obviously I'll just do this manuscript because it's super cool. But the problem is it's 400 pages. So it's not like a few pages that you can analyze. It's like so chock-a-block full of content. And also what's interesting about it is we're not sure if it was written by a Christian or a Muslim. And I tried to really delve into that. And I still don't know if he's Christian or Muslim. In fact, he might have been Shia Muslim, which just, there was now three options.
Oh, wow.
So, but that was interesting because this guy was writing for the Sultan. How does that affect the general population? And what does it reveal to us about what people at the time were doing with their sexuality in ethics and practice?
It does sound really interesting. Now, I would guess for most people, it's probably a conception that sexuality is just something that faiths don't talk about. Like particularly in the Christian church, it's kind of something that's kept behind doors. But instead of avoiding it, you kind of lent right into it. So how do you approach topics of sexuality in different faiths and across faiths?
Well, I think I went into it with my own hang-ups about Christian sexuality and what I'd learned growing up in the church. That's why I was so interested in it, I guess. And I guess studying a different religion to my own makes it a bit easier to accept. Yeah. I mean, I ended up studying a lot of medieval Christian sexuality just because of the nature of interfaith studies. That's how I ended up in it. Also, sexuality is one of the most fundamental human ways of loving the other. And if I believe in that theological side of sexuality and, you know, the altar of marriage and it's supposed to be a taste of heaven, then going with that perspective was really quite interesting. And also in the medieval period, everyone just believed in God. So it's like given that your sexual ethics and practice, even though you might deviate or like do what you want, that basis there that God exists and that influences every single thing you do in your life is a lot more evident in medieval texts about sexuality. So their sex lives weren't separate from God. They were intertwined. And actually in this manuscript I was looking at and loads of other texts, It's like, how does God bless this? I mean, the author starts off saying that, like, this carnal union is to please God, and may God bless the words I'm about to write about sexuality. So they weren't shying away from it as much as we are.
So you said you were studying it in a faith that wasn't your own, the Muslim faith. What do you think are some of the misconceptions from Christianity about people who are Muslim and about Muslim modesty or religious practices?
I think one of the main things is that back then, all women veiled. So Christian women also would have had a headscarf, as well as Muslim women and Jewish women. I mean, you look at Mary in our own tradition and she has a headscarf. People would have dressed quite similarly. People would have had similar levels of modesty. So I think that's a big misconception. And something that I found really beautiful for my own faith is when I was in Jordan and I'd visit churches, especially Orthodox churches, I'd cover my hair. And also in Oxford, I lived in an Orthodox house and I would quite often go to the Russian Orthodox liturgy and I'd cover my hair like the other women did there for the church liturgy. And it was a very beautiful experience. And in the Catholic group that I go to, the church, the parish I go to, no one covers their hair. So it'd be really weird to just whip out a veil. So I don't do it. But actually, on my wedding day, I really want to look for a veil that covers my hair because I'm very interested in that.
Do you think women in Christianity that don't cover their hair are missing out?
I don't think that they're missing out because, you know, we've got our own understanding and interpretation from the church of whether or not you should veil. And it's really an individual thing. But I do think there is something about putting on the veil, entering the church, and it's like a very physical embodiment of submission to God. And I guess in Islam, you do that everywhere you go because there's other modesty implications in general society that there aren't in Christianity as much anymore. I wouldn't say they're missing out, you know, but I think it's an interesting thing to sort of discover that actually I didn't feel oppressed. I felt very like, wow, this is so special.
I guess that's a quite common then misconception. So what would you say to people who do have a stereotypical misconception of Islam or Muslim people?
I would say that Muslims are just normal people, you know, they're just living their lives. Whatever culture you come from or the denomination in Islam that a family comes from is going to shape their views and their ways of living out their faith. I would say that Muslims in this country, from a fundraising perspective and a charity perspective, donate way more to charity than even Christians do. Like the stats back that up, and they do a lot of good for the community with food banks and all sorts of things going on. I mean, I had a friend, her local mosque during Ramadan. I didn't see her because there was a food bank every single day and they would break the fast, not only with fellow Muslims, but they would cook extra food and give it out on the streets. Like, I'm not saying that there's no problems with understanding each other and like assimilation and different interpretations of faith. I'm not saying that like there's no issues there, but I think there is a lot of misunderstanding about that. And I think that the emphasis on family life is so beautiful.
You were saying about the food banks, and I think some of the greatest examples I've seen of interreligious work are when you have different faith centres running a different like night shelter every night. So one night it might be like the Catholic Church, the next night it might be the mosque, the next night it might be the synagogue. And it's just a beautiful example of how faiths can work together to have that practical way of putting their faith into action. Would you encourage people to work more in the interreligious space?
Yes, I would, because I think it's really important to understand the other and to understand people that are different from you and what their views are and what you can both do together to make the world a better place, to use that cliche. I also do think it's important, though, from an interfaith perspective, that as a Christian, I'm not going in to try and convert the other person. I'm accepting them as they are, and we're having fruitful dialogue and doing fruitful projects, as you said, like running food banks and homeless shelters. And if the agenda goes further than that makes me a bit uncomfy, even though actually I come from a Catholic group that is very much about proselytizing. But I don't know, it's just so important. Like, you know, I'm not going to go to my teacher's house in Jordan and they're so friendly to me and just start being like, you have to believe in Jesus Christ or you're damned. Like, I'm not going to do that, you know? because actually the church teaches that they are our brothers and sisters under God, to be held in high esteem and to work for social justice and freedom together. And like, I always fall back on that. So yeah.
Yeah, I agree. When you step into that interreligious space, it's important to be open and showing the love of God, but by doing that in a way that you witness Jesus and living out your faith. So what do you wish you knew before you stepped into the interreligious space and before you studied Islam?
I wish I just knew that there was so much carryover. I wish I knew that the majority of the population at the time when Islam came around was still Christian, and there was so much interfaith carryover. And I wish I knew that, like, during human history, there's times of violence, yes, but there's also times of peace. And there's also just times of, like, getting along and just living life. And, like, you're both in the same marketplace and, like, you might not like each other, but you just do it. I also wish I knew that the Islamic God also smiles. And the reason I say that is because at uni, we studied this 13th century theologian that wrote this whole thing on, like, does God laugh? And from an Islamic perspective, it's interesting because you might accidentally be putting human attributes on God. But his conclusion was that God does laugh. And I just think it's quite nice to think that our God smiles.
That is nice. And talking of smiling, what are you grateful for?
I think I'm very grateful for all the opportunities I've had because, you know, my Oxford degree was really expensive, but I got 9 scholarships. And sometimes I feel a bit guilty because I'm not currently in the academic world and I didn't do as well as I wanted to do. But I'm just so grateful that I had that opportunity to be there and to learn so much and be in a space of research. I'm also so grateful that I got to go to Jordan again on a scholarship and meet so many different people. I have so many different groups of friends now as a result that enrich me. I'm just so grateful for all those opportunities. And I'm also grateful to God for everything that he's done for me and how he provides.
Thanks for listening to Things I Wish I Knew. What's going to stay with me from this episode is the importance of interreligious work. How about you? We'd love to hear how Maria's story resonated with you. And why not also tell us if you're facing an experience you wish you knew how to look at differently? It might just be something we can help with. And you can find out about this theme and others by going to thinkingfaith.org. Thank you again for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time on Things I Wish I Knew.